The student was stumped and just couldn't finish a paper. It was not unheard of for Oppie to just do it himself. One night in 1939, he invited Joe Weinberg and Hartland Snyder up to his home on Shasta Road. The two young graduate students had collaborated on a paper but felt unable to write a satisfactory conclusion. "He gave us the usual obligatory tumbler of whiskey," Weinberg recalled, "and he put on some music to keep me busy." Hartland drifted around looking at books while Oppie sat down at the typewriter. After a half hour, he had hammered out the last paragraph, a beautiful paragraph. The paper, Stationary States of Scalar and Vector Fields, was published in Physical Review in 1940. Oppenheimer's lectures were invariably accompanied by a slew of formulas written on the blackboard. But like most theoreticians, he had no respect for mere formulas. Weinberg, whom Oppenheimer had come to regard as one of his brightest students, observed that mathematical formulas were like temporary handholds for a rock climber. Each handhold more or less dictates the position of the next handhold. "A record of that," Weinberg said, "is a record of a particular climb. It gives you very little of the shape of the rock." For Weinberg and others, being in a course with Oppie was like experiencing lightning flashes 5 or 10 times in an hour, so brief that you might have missed them. If you were scrounging formulas off a blackboard, you might very well not have known they were there at all. Very often these flashes were basic philosophical insights that placed physics in a human context. Oppenheimer thought that no one could be expected to learn quantum mechanics from books alone. The verbal wrestling inherent in the process of explanation is what opens the door to understanding. He never gave the same lecture twice. "He was very keenly aware," Weinberg recalled, "of the people in his class." He could look into the faces of his audience and suddenly decide to change his entire approach because he had sensed what their particular difficulties were with the subject at hand. Once he gave an entire lecture on a problem he knew would pique the interest of just one student. Afterwards, that student rushed up to him and said he wanted permission to tackle the problem. Oppenheimer replied, "Good, that's why I gave the seminar." Oppenheimer gave no final exams, but he handed out plenty of homework assignments. During each class hour, he presented a non-Socratic lecture, delivered at high speed, recalled Ed Gerjoy, a graduate student from 1938 to 1942. Students felt free to interrupt Oppie with a question. "He generally would answer patiently," Gerjoy said, "unless the question was manifestly stupid, in which event his response was likely to be quite caustic." Oppenheimer was brusque with some students, but he treated those who were vulnerable with a gentle hand. One day when Weinberg was in Oppenheimer's office, he began rummaging through papers stacked on the trestle table in the center of the room. Picking out one paper, he began reading the first paragraph, oblivious to Oppie's irritated look. "This is an excellent proposal," Weinberg exclaimed. "I'd sure as hell like to work on it." To his astonishment, Oppenheimer replied curtly, "Put that down. Put it back where you found it." When Weinberg asked what he had done wrong, Oppenheimer said, "That was not for you to find." A few weeks later, Weinberg heard that another student who was struggling to find the thesis topic had begun work on the proposal he had read that day. "The student was a very genial, decent man," Weinberg recalled, "but, unlike a few of us who enjoyed the kind of challenge that Oppie threw out like sparks, he was often baffled and nonplussed and ill at ease. Nobody had the courage to tell him, 'Look, you're out of your depth.'" Weinberg now realized that Oppie had planted this thesis problem for this very student. It was a distinctly easy problem. "But it was perfect for him," Weinberg said, "and it got him his PhD. It would have been difficult for him to get it with Oppie if Oppie had treated him the way he treated me or Phil Morrison or Sid Dankoff." Instead, Weinberg insisted years later, Oppie nurtured this student as a father would have treated a baby learning to walk. "He waited for him to discover that proposal accidentally, on his own terms, to pick it up and to express his interest, to find his way to it. He needed special treatment, and by God, Oppie was going to give it to him. It showed a great deal of love, sympathy, and human understanding." The student in question, Weinberg reported, went on to do distinguished work as an applied physicist. Weinberg quickly became a devoted member of Oppenheimer's inner circle. "He knew that I adored him," Weinberg said, "as we all did. Philip Morrison, Giovanni Rossi Lomanitz, David Bohm, and Max Friedman were some of the other graduate students who regarded Oppenheimer as their mentor and role model during these years. These were unconventional young men who, in the words of Morrison, prided themselves on being self-conscious and daring intellectuals. All of them were studying theoretical physics, and all of them were active in one or another popular front cause. Some, like Philip Morrison and David Bohm, have acknowledged that they joined the Communist Party. Others were merely on the fringe. Joe Weinberg was probably in the party for at least a brief time. Morrison, born in 1915 in Pittsburgh, grew up not far from Kitty Oppenheimer's childhood home.
After a public school education, he received a B.S. in physics from Carnegie Institute of Technology in 1936.
That autumn, he went to Berkeley to study theoretical physics under Oppenheimer. A victim of childhood polio, he arrived on campus wearing a brace on one leg. As a child convalescing from the disease, he had spent a great deal of time in bed and learned to speed read at 5 pages a minute. As a graduate student, Morrison impressed everyone with his wide range of knowledge about almost anything, from military history to physics. In 1936, he joined the Communist Party. But though he didn't hide his left-wing political views, neither did he advertise his party membership. His office mate at Berkeley in the late 1930s, Dale Corson, was unaware that Morrison was a CP member. "We were all close to communism at that time," Bohm recalled. Actually, until 1940-41, Bohm didn't have much sympathy for the Communist Party. But then, with the collapse of France, it seemed to him that no one but the communists had the will to resist the Nazis. Indeed, many Europeans appeared to prefer the Nazis to the Russians. "And I felt," Bohm said, "that there was such a trend in America, too. I thought the Nazis were a total threat to civilization. It seemed that the Russians were the only ones that were really fighting them." Then I began to listen to what they said more sympathetically.